Coming up on the next BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast, an exclusive interview with Marcus Flash, the head of BMW Motorrad. Take a listen.
The principle of having an M model on top of a very sporty BMW product range always made sense. And it for me, was clear that we have the strongest or the most powerful ladder in the world within our portfolio. So,
Marcus Flash took over as head of BMW Motorrad in November of 2023. Marcus was already a well-known figure at BMW Motorrad, having been at the helm of the M division when it was decided to introduce the first M motorcycle, the M1000RR. As the new head of Motorrad, Marcus has already begun to make an impression as an innovative and decisive leader. But what is his vision for the brand, and how does he plan to implement this vision? While in Munich, my producer Louise Powers and I sat down with Marcus to discuss his history, his passions, and his plans for the future of BMW Motorrad. Please subscribe to Ride and Talk and leave a comment on this and other episodes. We love to hear from you and appreciate your feedback and support. Now let's take a listen to Marcus Flash, the head of BMW Motorrad. We were in Salzburg.
Yeah, right before here.
And you live in Salzburg, yeah?
I live half an hour south of Salzburg on a farm, but I passed through Salzburg when I got to Munich.
And we heard a rumor that you like to rock climb.
I do. I climbed Matterhorn last year in summer.
Oh, yeah.
It was the biggest tour so far.
That is cool. We love to climb. Louise is far better than I, but we were in Salzburg and walking, and you cannot walk more than 10 meters without going up a mountain.
Yeah. Like it's I mean, crazy. I live on a farm. It's actually on a mountain, and from the lowest part to the highest part of my own property, it's 200 meters in height difference.
Oh,
and it's not a big farm. It's just steep.
So we've been sort of social media stalking you a little. Mm-hmm. And you have what I've named the magic garage. And I think this is at your farm, yeah? It's like it's all wood and like the door opens and like there's a new toy being rolled out.
Yeah, it's a bit like a playground. I mean, officially it's like a stable where I would have to have cattle and sheep and so on, but no animal has so far touched ground there.
Could it be called a farm?
It is a farm. The sheep, they live at the neighbors. I've got some cars and some bikes there, and some mountain bikes and road cycles.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a private collection.
Yeah, so I was sort of scouring through and I saw, so you've got this R9T race.
Yeah.
That you had a picture, and the backdrop is insane.
Yeah, it's quite cool. We called it the signature shot because also in my M time when we started with this whole social media stuff, most of the pictures I took from the cars, I did that in front of the house with the mountains in the background. So the team always loves if I sent them pictures because in the beginning I thought they'd get bored.
Yeah.
But then I thought, no, it's this kind of develops to a signature perspective. We could keep this.
Yeah. Marcus has got a new toy this week.
Yeah. Exactly.
Here's a picture. I saw a couple of bikes. It looked like I saw the R9T race. I saw a Moto Guzzi. It looked like. Is that part of your collection too?
That's a long story, actually. Long before I joined BMW, I ran into Karl-Heinz Kalbfell. He was a former vice president of marketing in BMW, and then he was the guy that built up Mini and later on Rolls-Royce within BMW, and he was also head of motorsport. So this gentleman, he became like a father-like friend for me and coached me and guided me through the business long before I joined BMW. And actually, he was the one who brought me to motorcycling. I did my license when I was 18, but I never started to ride until I was probably 27, 28, when I met Karl-Heinz, and we were traveling business-wise through Russia and on also Europe. And I started with all of the stories that he used to tell me about what he lived in BMW and what he experienced. I kind of arrived at the decision to start riding myself. And then he coached me also in this respect and said, well, you should start on a bike that's not too fast. And so he gave me a Guzzi, Moto Guzzi V7, what is it, 1975 build, and he rented, or he gave it to me for a summer.
Wow.
And so I rode this bike. I lived in Vienna at that time. And by the end of the season, I didn't want to return it. And so he sold it to me. That was my first Moto Guzzi as like a black Guzzi ambassador. And I'd say 3-4 years later, we originally planned to go to the Isle of Man together for the race, for the classic TT, not for the real. And we were supposed to go on the race on two matchless bikes that were built for him. One on me, one for me, one for him. And then I couldn't go to that, to the Isle of Man in that particular year because I had a surgery on my knee. And then he went to go on the Lansdowne Classic.
Yeah.
And had a race on Brands Hatch on that particular weekend where we were supposed to race the Isle of Man, and he died in this race in Brands Hatch. And that was one of the worst days in my life. And then later on, like a half year later, I bought the remaining two Moto Guzzis out of his collection from his son. So today it's three Moto Guzzis, and I will keep them forever because they remind me of one of my best friends.
That's a beautiful testament. That's good stuff. So I'm looking at this bike behind you that you've got on your floor, and it's nothing that anybody's ever seen.
There are articles on the classic bike magazines about this bike already existing. It's a bike that we built in 2007 together with an Italian company called Oral Racing.
Yeah.
And this was the attempt to enter MotoGP by then. We decided not to, but this is actually a 800cc three-cylinder, according to the rules of the time.
Wow.
Prototype, but they just put it into the basement.
Yeah.
Instead of entering, and I got it from this particular basement in our archive in my time when I was CEO of BMW M, and they didn't have a problem putting it to my office instead of keeping it in the basement. And since then, I bring it along with every position I take in BMW. Now it fits actually quite well.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the perfect office for it.
Now, when you mentioned like the BMW archive basement, I imagine this giant dusty warehouse where you flip a switch and lights open up and there's like hundreds of things that everybody wants to see. Please tell me that's what it is.
It is much better. You cannot believe. When I went there for the first time, I didn't believe what I saw. I think it's 4 or 5 stories.
Yeah.
Two of them underground, from outside, very unspectacular. And we keep pretty much from every single model that we have ever produced, we keep one piece there. So from 3 series to the race cars and the art cars and the motorbikes.
Yeah.
It's amazing. There is this. No, I cannot tell too much because everybody would try to find
everyone
out where it is.
To go there now.
When we had a product workshop the other week because I want to do something on the upcoming or the next generation of the electric scooters. I want to do something similar to what we've done with the C1 originally. So this is what we're trying to develop right now in an early phase. So I knew that there were some variants of the original C1 in the archive that had never been produced or even published. So we met there with the product team and looked at these crazy ideas of at the time they had with the C1. There's even a C1 with wings. I'm not kidding. Not a helicopter, but with wings. And all types of motorsport and off-road and it was crazy. So we used it as an inspiration and had our product workshop there.
Now, do you have people on the team now that were around during the development of the C1?
Yeah, actually, one of the person in charge of the upcoming program was part of the original team.
Wow.
Oh, that's
there
cool.
There are many of them around. I mean, some of them ride them today going to work.
Oh, we saw one yesterday, actually, just in the street in Munich when we were out.
I think this it was an amazing concept. We were probably a bit too early,
yeah,
and it had some flaws. I mean, the engine was not fantastic, the noise it makes, and also the look a bit awkward. But the concept of commuting without a helmet and being protected from wind and weather is a masterpiece, and we probably can do it a little bit better in an electric world.
Yeah.
But still, going to a city center without bothering of the about the weather and messing around with your hair. I mean, we don't have the problem, the two of us, but you, is I think
he just called you bald.
I might grow my hair back just to let it flow in the wind. I remember when the C1 first came out, they had an advertisement and it was the famous stunt rider, Jean-Pierre Goy, and he's riding this bike and he would intentionally crash it
Oh, really?
To show. Yeah. And it was to show how the vehicle would keep you protected even when it slid down the road. And Jean Pierre Goy is the guy that rode the R1200C in the 007 movie. You know, he's jumping it off of the tops of buildings. He's just this tiny little guy that's just a maniac on a bike. And every, you know, of course, we didn't get to see one in the US, but we saw this and went, oh, yeah, that is so cool. And the idea of it being electric.
Yeah.
Because we just rode the CE02s and 04s.
What do you think?
They're really fun.
Yeah.
The 02 especially is kind of a, we would call it like a hooligan bike.
Yeah.
Like, I was tempted to do silly things.
But it kind of invites for this type of playing, doesn't it?
Well, I wasn't doing any different on the CE02. It was so much fun. It, like, you get on it and you start to twist that little e-throttle and it just wants to do all sorts of fun things.
Yeah, very approachable.
Absolutely.
It's like a first time a bike par excellence. If you've ever, if you've never been on a bike before and you get on a CE02, it's like riding a bicycle.
Yeah. It's interesting, the idea of e-mobility, because, you know, BMW has been playing in this world, starting with the C-Evolution, and the idea of giving it a hook other than being electric. The C1 hook, you know, having the hood over the, you know, the protection of it, is really interesting idea. How did you come to this conclusion?
Well, first of all, we had to change the direction in terms of electric mobility within Motorrad, because what we see in the market is, if you look at other competition, is that people are customers are very reluctant on buying fully blown electric motorcycles. Mm. So. And those are not bad products, but if you look at the use case, and if you look at the promise that we give our customers, being independent, don't have to think where you're going, looking at the spirit like we transport with the GS, you kind of arrive at a point where you say that the least thing you want to have on the big tour is being dependent on a charging infrastructure.
Yeah,
and then you look at the products that we could do in terms of power to weight and also price tag.
Yeah.
And you arrive at a point that also in a on-road, like in a Sportster or even double R segment, there is just no point for a product that could take it with an R or with a double R.
Yeah.
And the third argument that we arrived at is that there is no CO2 emission foreseeable or categorization foreseeable as we have in the four-wheel business. So the only reason why you would deliberately choose to go on an electric bike is if you're going to the city, and there it makes a whole lot of sense, as you experienced both on the CE2 and or CE04. But we don't see for the next years any customer to go to a shop, buy a bike, to ride it around the lake on the weekend or up a mountain pass.
Yeah.
So the change in strategy is fundamental, but also very, very logic that we will stick to urban electric mobility for some more years to come.
Yeah.
And then the consequence of putting it as far as the successor of a C1 on an electric basis is the next thing that's very logic, because the flaws that the bike had were mainly connected to the petrol engine and the sound. So yeah, the direction is urban mobility, electric, and getting a C1 out of it.
Yeah. I wonder, you came to us from motorsport and you were running motorsport at a very critical time, which is, to us, very critical, because it was the time when finally we saw Motorrad come over to motorsport. It was actually quite a surprise, certainly to us, when suddenly they said, like, we're now going to have an MRR. And we go, of course, we go straight to an MGS.
Yeah, of course.
We'll talk about that later.
We can.
But I do wonder, how did that process come to, I mean, after, I know they, Motorrad must have been asking to be a part of M since there's been the most powerful letter in the alphabet. Like, how did it finally come to be?
I think it was like in 2019 or so when I had this, the discussion with Markus Schramm at the time. But it was a very short discussion because it was just plain logic to me.
Yeah.
The principle of having an M model on top of a very sporty BMW product range on the car side always made sense. And it works in both directions. So the non-M models profit from the image of the M model, and the M model profits from the very solid basis of the original product line. So for me, it was clear that we should no longer try to work on HP or any other sporty sub-brand within Motorrad if we have the strongest or the most powerful letter in the world within our portfolio. So it was quite easy for me to approve that decision, because they had to formally ask M if we are standing behind it. But it was, for me, very logic to do that.
Yeah.
We had one prerequisite, and that was that we will not do M styles just for the style purpose. It has to have a solid content product-wise, as we do on the cars.
Yeah.
So with the way we put the most powerful letter on, there must be the most powerful technology.
So we've met quite a few product managers from various areas of Motorrad, and they're so passionate, these people. They live in dream motorcycles. And so I wonder, when you finally came to be like, okay, we're going to have an M, did they just run to you the next day with already made prototypes? Like, did they, because it would be my guess that they had secretly been preparing for this for a long time.
Yeah, of course they didn't start from scratch at the time. They were just asking for permission to put the letter on. The bike was pretty much developed at the time, the MW. We put some more ingredients on. We had some M Motorsport guys work on aerodynamics and also on the engine to even refine it a bit more, but then that was it. Mm. And the subsequent models, they were just logically derived from it. I don't, that's also an open secret. I don't see that the M has to be limited to four-cylinder on-road.
Yeah.
So if you look back into the history, if you look at the Dakar versions of the original GS, the M was always there.
Yeah. HP2.
Yeah, the exactly. HP2. Yeah.
Oh, we just, that bike is a cult classic.
Yeah.
Everybody loves that bike. Yeah. And we interviewed Edgar Heinrich, you know, and asked him, like, is there going to be a new HP2? He's like, no one's ever asked me this question before. And we said, really? He says, no, I get it every single day. So now you've got the M happening for Motorrad. And of course, you're here and we're seeing success with BMW and World Superbike. And as I'm interviewing here, I'm looking behind you at BMW's original concept for MotoGP. That's the question. Like, will we, how far will we push bringing M into this and certainly into competition?
Yeah, and there's not a big secret that I'm a big fan of MotoGP.
Yeah.
If you just look at the sport, I mean, World Superbike is fantastic. If you watch the races, the level of sport that our athletes show there is at least comparable to MotoGP. There is not a big difference. The difference is the reach.
Yeah.
And the global footprint. This is what has to make me rethink our strategy, because the World Superbike series is basically a European series with one race in Australia. Mm-hmm. We are the global leading premium manufacturer of motorcycles. So we miss racing in the Americas. We miss racing in Asia.
Yeah.
And this is what MotoGP could offer for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the logic part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also think that if the Dorna continues to have like the MotoGP positioned as the number one platform, there is also a push for us as the leading manufacturer to be in the number one platform. But we need to find a way to make this happen. I mean, we're not just spending money. We need to define the business model, how we would do it. And then we'll see. In 27, everybody starts from scratch, and this is probably the time that we would need to hit.
Let's mark our calendars, Louise.
Yeah.
27.
27.
We're coming back. We're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
We're thinking about it.
So we also, when scouring through your social media, you put up this fantastically tasty photo, and it's you looking under a cover at a new motorcycle. And you said something amazing is coming. And this particular motorcycle had an exposed drive shaft. So immediately we went to, this has got to be the big boxer twin. This has got to be some variant of the R18. What can you tell us about your feelings about the R18 and what's to come?
Again, there are a logic part of the investigation that we do, and then there is a very emotional part to it. When we launched the R12, the journalists, they love it. It's very approachable. It's not too heavy. It's not too big. There are variants suitable for all types of riders. That the only thing that I personally have with the R12 is it's not a really big bike for big people.
Mm.
So if I think there is room on top of an R12 for a larger scale motorcycle that not necessarily has to be a feet forward cruiser.
Mm.
So this is the logic part. I think that there is a blank spot in our portfolio, and when we closed or thought more closely, then we had a look at the engine and what we can do out of the engine.
Yeah.
Talking about size, there is some room in displacement that we could use. And when we looked at the ergonomy, and the R18 is a fantastic bike, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of a bike that's something like an large scale R90.
Yeah.
With the most iconic engine that we have in portfolio.
Yeah.
This bike is going to be something like a mechanical cathedral. Yeah. It's basically the big boxer engine with not much around.
Mm.
We will show it in the Villa d'Este end of May.
Oh, okay.
We will disclose it to the public, and it's a concept bike.
Yeah.
And then we will see what the reaction is. I've seen it. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it resonates with you if we speak about a huge R90.
Yeah.
That should actually resonate with you a lot. You love the R90, but you talk about the fact that it is too small for you.
I'm too big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
a little ridiculous. Yeah. I'm a GS guy, and it's not because I don't love sport bikes and R90s and whatnot. It's just I fit on a GS. I'm good. And I've seen that you've ridden GSs too. And do you, coming from a motorsport background, where do you fit in terms of your passion for bikes in general? Is the sport bike is always first? Where does the GS fit?
It's actually hard to tell. I did some racing up to 2015, 16 when my first kid was born, and something changed in my brain. I don't do so much racetrack anymore. I did this last weekend again, and it felt strangely awkward after 5, 6, 7 years not racing.
Yeah,
to be on an extremely competent double R on a racetrack, it's a bit, it's a lot for your brain to take.
Mm.
It's hard to tell. I mean, if I would have to pick one bike currently, it'd probably be a GS.
Yeah,
because it's so versatile. It transports the thought of freedom, of make life a ride. Perfectly for me. I spent 3 years in a row now doing GS holidays.
Hmm.
And we started 3 years ago with Sweden, then we went to Italy in the next year, and last year we went to Norway.
Yeah.
1 week GS adventure, just go. And this is the spirit that no other bike can deliver. It's so competent. Whatever gets into your way, you'll get over it.
It's a fascinating time to be here too. The GS, we've seen this such incredible evolution with the 1300, and we were all, when the 900 came out, we just rode it for the first time, and we went, whoa. Whoa.
Totally unexpected, isn't it?
Totally
unexpected.
And the first time I saw it was at the launch of the 1300, and it was on display next to it, and nobody paid any attention to it because it's 1300s there. That's the icon. That's what we all want to see. But now everybody relaxed a little bit. Everybody's gotten used to the 13 and are excited about it. But then we ride this and we go.
Yeah. I mean, off-road is for me a new playing field. I've never done any off-road riding in my life, besides that I'm riding mountain bikes since I'm a kid. So
sure. There
is some basic talent, but I've started with off-road motorcycle riding just this spring.
Mm-hmm.
Did some 3 days intensive training in Malaga, and it's for me incredible, absolutely incredible how competent even a big GS is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On off-road tires. And if you trust the machine and get your brain around it, just letting it do what it does best.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I think too that it's so understated and so important, the training.
Yeah, absolutely.
You put yourself in front of somebody that really knows how to teach, and you can accelerate and make that GS do amazing things.
Yeah.
I mean, we see it after just one day with training, let alone three.
I went from zero to like maybe 50% competent in 3 days.
That's good stuff.
That's cool.
Garmisch. It's Motorhead days. Like, I've never been to Garmisch.
Me neither.
No?
No. I passed through Garmisch many times since I live close to Garmisch, but I've never been to the Motorrad days there.
Yeah. And it was one of your first decisions from what we understand.
Yeah, that was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with Berlin. And I think the idea of having the 100 years anniversary celebration in Berlin is right, or was right at the time. And I probably would have decided the same. What I did not like about the decision was that we sacrificed Garmisch for it. And there is no need for that. So when I came here, I think it was my second or third week, I said, for 2024, we cancel Berlin. And then they said to me, well, we don't have an option. And then I said, then cancel Berlin. We will not have the Motorrad days in a city center. It's nothing to do with Berlin. We will not want to do it in Berlin. We will not do it in Munich. It's the year of the GS. Then the Motorrad days have to be in the mountains, period. And we took it then. We canceled Berlin, and then we saw what our options might be. And then it wasn't just Garmisch. We also looked at two or three other options. But we were very happy that we found out that also Garmisch was very delighted that we were investigating returning. Yeah. So we ended up making a decision that we would go to Garmisch. And I think it's going to be a fantastic party.
That decision has definitely been welcomed around the world. You can see it in people's reactions. They're very excited to be going back to Garmisch.
Yeah. That's good stuff. And because we've never been.
I know.
We must see this place.
We're definitely excited.
And then you have to come to Motorrad Days Americas.
Baba.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard many good things about it.
Yeah.
I will.
So cool.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, you know, to see, you know, 80,000 people on motorcycles all coming together and being so happy.
Yeah.
It's like, it's exactly what I got on the motorcycles for. Yeah. It's good stuff. Now, I'm curious. We've met a lot of the team that that you work with here. And it's fascinating to me, the idea of coming in with very new ideas, very defined direction, and maybe even sometimes provocative ideas on what you want to do with Motorrad. How do you go about taking all of these people who maybe have very passionate ideas in other directions and steer together where you want to go?
Well, what unifies us even more than on the BMW passenger car side is the spirit. We all riders, or most of us are riders, and changing direction for many of them is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
If you talk motorsport, if you talk what we want to do out of the R18 engine, if we talk about the C1, it wasn't a tough thing to do. Originally, when I came here, I thought I need to take some time and then listen and learn. But some of the decisions, like Garmisch, had to be taken in my first 2-3 weeks, and well, they took it very professionally, took the challenge without having a solution, accepting the challenge. It's a very flexible, very agile team of people, of enthusiasts that work here with me in Munich and also in Berlin. It's, how should I say, not easy. Easy is the wrong word, but a very high standard of leadership in BMW Motorrad.
Mm-hmm. From the outside looking in, I would think that the culture at M was not all that dissimilar from the culture in Motorrad, just because there is so much passion that is put into that letter. Is it all that different?
The spirit within BMW M is pretty close to the spirit here. We do like the same sales per year, like 200,000 more or less, plus minus vehicles to the M community, and 200,000 vehicles to the Motorrad community. And this is about a size where you can still handle the interaction and learn from the direct feedback. I mean, we're doing 2.5 million BMWs globally.
Yeah.
It's hard to get your arms around it and to understand what the customers really like. And in both BMW M and Motorrad, this is a bit easier and more approachable.
You know, we always have discussions about bikes like the R18 and Heritage line, and of course the GS line and the Sport line. You know, what we don't talk about much is the touring.
Yeah.
You know, the R1250 RT, which is such a critical motorcycle.
And the K1600 line.
Which we own.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
1600 baggers.
Oh, the bagger.
Just the coolest bike. It is so cool.
I've never been on one.
Oh, we have to get you on one.
Yeah, I will, definitely.
Absolutely.
Just a question of time.
Yeah.
One of my favorite motors ever.
But it has to be in the USA, though.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that bike feels like it was made for US roads. So we have to go take on the tail of the dragon.
It's a very, very stable group of customers, and for us a very, very stable market.
Yeah,
we sell almost as many six cylinders as we sell R18 without doing much advertisement, without pushing. It's just people who have the six cylinder want the next six cylinder. And for me, there is no reason to discontinue the bike.
Yeah, that must. And it doesn't seem, you know, where do we see provocative changes happen in the touring category? Do we, you know, will then I know we'll see the next RT at some point, you know, do we see that bike give us more of what we come to love about it? Or do we make a provocative change? Like some people say we did with the GS.
I've test ridden the new RT on Wednesday. We were in South France and we were test riding the upcoming models.
Yeah.
Also for me, a first time on an RT, the bike gets more approachable and even it's agile. It's agile to a point that it's literally completely unexpected. You look at a huge bike, wind and weather protection. The next in the next generation, there will be also some surprise to this chapter with some, how should I say, adaptable elements of the bodywork. Quite interesting and very functional. The way the new RT handles completely surprised me because it's super quick around the corner and it follows direction with very little impact or with very little steering impact that you need. So I think it if you look at the step that we did from the 1250 to the 1300 GS and elaborate this on the RT, you already have a quite good sense of where it's going.
It's when I used to sell BMW motorcycles, how I got started, and the biggest decision a customer had to make was always between the GS and the RT, because these two bikes, although completely different categories, the riding posture was so comfortable on each one. People go, do I really want to ride off road or do I want to have all of these nice accoutrements, you know, the power windscreen. Of course, now we're seeing that on the GS, but it's good.
Yeah, it's a bit like deciding between a 5 Series or X5. I put it that way.
I chose the X5. But what are you looking forward to for this year and beyond?
Well, definitely Garmisch for me. Yeah. Garmisch is a huge highlight. And the Villa d'Este, as already said, where we will show the concept. I'm very, very excited because I'm taking this bike very personal. It was my personal initiative to do it in the first place. So the feedback that this bike is going to receive or not is... For me personally, very important. And then I'm looking forward to many more victories in World Superbike with Toprak. I'm very happy with this guy.
Yeah.
Also, how Michael and Van der Mark is developing is amazing. And there is the type of teamwork that I've seen in Barcelona in the box between Toprak and Michael.
Yeah.
Is exactly what we want to see for the brand, because we do racing just for the brand.
Yeah.
And the way those two gentlemen work with the team, work with each other, represent our values is just, it's just a delight. And I've been for dinner with Toprak this week on Monday in Munich, very casual.
Yeah.
What an amazing character. Fits into our family very well. And these are going to be the highlights of the season, seeing the brand win.
Yeah. Good stuff. Marcus, this has been awesome, man. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
So I see you in Garmisch.
Yeah, we'll see you there for sure.
Rock on. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it this one.
We very much hope you have enjoyed this episode. We want to hear from you, so please rate, comment, and share your thoughts about this podcast. We have many more episodes on the way, so please subscribe, follow along, and share your requests for future episodes of the BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk Podcast.